This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We have to be suspicious of our food these days. Who knows what's on it, you know, pesticides or whether it's genetically malformed or where it came from. Not to mention the insane carbon miles of flying fresh food halfway around the world to supermarket. That's no way to live. And there are food revolutionaries out there. Michael Brownlee has been in this good food fight for years. In 2011, I interviewed Michael about the transition movement. In 2016, we talked about his book, The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. Now Michael's back and he's gone a step further. He's got a new book linked up with an online video and a training course coming. And the book is Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. Michael Brownlee, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you again.
It's been a long struggle to keep local food growing. How's it going in Colorado?
Well, actually, it appears to be going well in Colorado with local food, but as we have learned over the years, we have actually not moved the needle very much. We're still at somewhere between 1 and 2% local food in this state. We're about, I think, number 32 on the locavore index of states in the country.
Right. Well, I know that Canadian cities are getting more local food. I see it, well, it's partly due to that book, 100 Mile Diet by Elisa Smith and James McKinnon that came out a few years ago.
Sure.
And I head into restaurants, I see they've got local food on the menu and they mark it very clearly, but I guess most of their menu is from somewhere else. And we've got busy farmers markets. On the days when farmers markets are open, it looks about as busy as some supermarkets. So I see those as signs of progress, but like you say, long way to go.
Long way to go. And as a nation, the United States is, well, actually, if we look at the total food supply in this country, which is about a $5.3 trillion market, local food represents 0.3% of all of that. So what that means is that the rest of our food supply is industrial food, you know, and the problem is not just that, you know, it's better for us, better for our health, better for the environment and all that to be eating local food. The problem is that the industrial food system, which dominates our food supply almost entirely, is really the most destructive industry in the world. And it's the number one contributor to global warming. So we've been feeling the need to localize our food supply as much as possible over, you know, the last dozen years or so. But unfortunately, local food has become seen as primarily an optional lifestyle choice for the economically privileged. So local food has never been seen as something important, let alone urgent, for communities to take on as an overriding priority.
Right. If we go down to City Hall where we live and ask them, well, what are you doing about local food? They may have some inkling. They may have a small project, but that isn't what they spend most of their time talking about.
That's right. And, you know, part of the reason for this is that people have a poor understanding in general of the industrial food system and how destructive it is. And even more importantly, as we're learning now, almost no one realizes that the impact of global warming on the food supply will be tremendous in the next few decades. And the impact of all of that will be primarily on our industrial food system, on monocultured commodity crops, especially in the breadbasket regions of the world. So as we start to understand the new science that's becoming available to us around that, we start realizing, oh, we don't have any choice but to quickly localize our food supply in our communities on a regional basis to the greatest extent possible, because we're facing nothing less than a global food catastrophe that will reduce our food production capacity by in the neighborhood of half, 50%, by 2050. And that doesn't mean it's going to start in 2050. It's already started now. We're seeing the reduction of food production capacity because it turns out that warming, global warming, each degree Celsius of global warming that takes place, it cuts food production capacity, crop yields, in other words, by 10% per degree Celsius. So if you look at the numbers that some of your guests have been suggesting we might be facing, you know, anywhere from, 2 to 6 degrees Celsius over the next several decades. Some of the more bold of them saying we could see 4 to 6 degrees even by 2050. We realize we're in serious trouble for our food system.
Yes, I see that all the time as a climate reporter, and I'm reminded first off, of course, the California drought that just went by, and many, many acres of food that just had to be left out there. There was no water for them. But I'm thinking, too, of the 2010 extreme heat event that hit Russia, and their grain crops, and they're the breadbasket for a large part of Asia, were just burned out. They had to stop all grain exports, wheat exports, and that drove up wheat prices around the world. It was part of the reason, possibly, of the revolution in Egypt, where buying bread is about 50% of the budget of everybody that lives there. You know, it's just this chain reaction of things that can happen if you get extreme weather events, and scientists tell us quite plainly you're going to get more and more extreme weather events. And along those lines, I noticed in your new book that you went to see the sequel, Al Gore's sequel of the climate movie.
Yes, An Inconvenient Truth, yeah.
Yeah, and you started thinking about what Al Gore did and how that could be applied to your local food leadership ideas. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we were impressed by what Al Gore did. You know, back in, I guess it was 2006, when he released An Inconvenient Truth as a book and as a film. And his intention was to change the whole public conversation about climate change and global warming. And he'd been developing a very elaborate presentation for years. He tried to incorporate all the best and latest research that was available, but he realized that he was just one voice out there. So he decided, besides creating the documentary and the book of An Inconvenient Truth, that he would train a cadre of community activists who could take his message out to their communities and to policymakers all over the world, actually. And he's been very successful with this. So his new film, An Inconvenient Sequel, tells the story of how he's actually personally trained over, tens of thousands of people to go out throughout the world. And you know, whatever we might think about Al Gore today, I think the intention, the strategy actually was brilliant. So it inspired us to begin training a cadre of people to raise awareness about the necessity for localizing our food supply to the greatest extent possible as quickly as possible. So to do that, we did two things. One, we weren't quite ready to do a documentary film like Al Gore did, but we created a new book, Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. And then we also created what we're calling the Local Food Academy, which is a three-month, very intensive training program for people who feel called to this work, who actually want to learn how they can radically accelerate and expand the local food movement in their communities. So we launched that in November, and we're getting ready to do the second version of that in March.
Now, is that a workshop where people go to Colorado to attend, or are you doing it online, or how does that work?
It's all online. With the exception of we're doing weekly sessions with people. There's a lot of online material that we offer them. And then at the end of the 3 months, we bring everybody together in Colorado for a three-day workshop. So we're planning four of those workshops a year. We're trying to build a community, a global community, actually, of food shed catalysts, if you will, people who are taking responsibility for leading this local food revolution in their communities. So it's a fairly radical approach, but it's a time-honored approach. You know, Richard Heinberg at Post Carbon Institute several years ago told us about the populist movement and the Farmers Alliance that grew up in the 1890s against corporate dominance of then both the Democratic and Republican parties. And so what the populist movement did was they trained a core of thousands of speakers to fan out across the country and to wake people up about that issue. They actually went out on horseback all over the country. Fortunately, we don't have to go out on horseback, but we can start right in our own communities and spread out from there.
But if we are going to other communities, horseback might be the way to go, a lot less carbon involved.
It's a little slow right now, and we need to move fairly quickly. We'll take advantage of, you know, automobile technologies and internet technologies and other communication technologies while they're available to us.
Okay, now, while they're available to us, and I think that this book assumes that we are on the verge of either an economic collapse or an ecological collapse or both, and I'm wondering, does this new local food movement depend on the collapse viewpoint, or can we find other reasons why we should be doing it and find enough drivers in those other reasons to make it happen? What do you think?
Well, there are lots and lots of good reasons for localizing our food supply, and we've been talking about them for years, but they haven't gotten a lot of traction. You know, we thought that probably the one reason that would really take hold was for economic development and rebuilding local economies. But, you know, we experienced here in Colorado, and this is true in many other places, that economic development government leaders are just not interested in that, because so much of the current economy is based upon industrial food production for export. It's an export-oriented economy. So they have pretty much ignored the possibility of economic development benefits of local food. The health benefits are obvious to anyone who's looking at it, and many people are. Many people have changed their lives really significantly bringing local and organic food into their diets, and that's been a very promising development, but it's still such a tiny part of our total food intake that it's just not enough. But when it finally comes down to realizing that if we don't localize our food supply to a pretty significant degree, not too far down the road, we will be facing famine, especially in our big cities, because they will just not have the capacity to feed themselves.
Tell us about Lynette Marie Hanthorn.
Yeah, Lynette Marie and I, she comes from Iowa. She was born and raised on a biodynamic dairy farm in Iowa and lived through the transition on that farm from biodynamic, which her family brought over from Germany, to what became colloquially known as conventional agriculture, industrial agriculture, using pesticides and artificial fertilizers and everything. She lived through that, although that experience nearly killed her. And we joined up about 22, 23 years ago and have been partners in this work ever since. So she's an essential part of what we're doing here.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, here with Michael Brownlee, author of Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. You offer 7 steps of developing a local food system, or at least taking ourselves in that direction. And I think, Michael, too many people have tried to skip from step 1, having the vision, right into step 4, radicalization, without those essential first things that you mentioned, like making connections and making a realistic assessment of the current reality. Why do we need those hard steps first before we get radical?
As Gus Speth likes to say, and has inspired us to say to many other people, we will never do what is necessary unless we know the full extent of our predicament. And, you know, I think most of us, including yourself, as we've been trying to grasp what our situation on this planet really is, we're just only in the last few years starting to get a handle of the reality that this planet is sliding into what is now being called the Anthropocene epoch. It is a period of biosphere disaster. You know, this is the worst catastrophic event on this planet since an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And it's caused by primarily our use of fossil fuels on this planet, and the number one contributor to the advent of the Anthropocene is the global industrial food system. You know, so we haven't understood this. We haven't understood even that, you know, 100 years ago, our diet in this country, our food supply in this country, was 100% organic, 100% local. And in a very short period of time, mostly since World War II, the industrial food system, which has been created by what we call an unholy alliance of big ag, big food, big pharma, and big oil, all backed by big banking and big government. So this industrial food system has undermined and stolen from us our food supply. And in the process, it has undermined and essentially destroyed democracy in this country. And the only way that we can regain our democracy, our food security, our food sovereignty, and chart a path forward into the difficult time of the Anthropocene is to build highly localized regional food sheds that can be our very resilient lifeboats into this very dark time that we're heading into. So there I tried to summarize the whole book.
And did a great job. But the thing is, when you talk like that, I know from twice now, having sort of started from the ground up my own gardening and more of my own food production, which has been a very healing thing for me, I must say, it takes time. You got to build your soil up for a couple of years. You find out in the third year that there's a pest you'd never seen before. In the fourth year, the frost knocks you out. So there's this lag time. Now, if we had a rather sudden and steep decline in something like the 2010 heat wave that broke the Russian wheat production, if we had, you know, a big event, where are we going to find the knowledge that's been knocked out, the lost wisdom of how to grow things? People don't know where their food comes from or how to grow it. We could be in trouble.
Well, it's quite likely that something like that will happen along the way. You know, we're working to raise awareness now so that we don't have to be forced into localizing our food supply overnight, like what happened in Cuba. You know, many people have seen the film, The Power of Community, how Cuba survived peak oil. You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba's supply of oil, which supported industrial agriculture there, was cut off. You know, and so they were plunged into a very difficult period of essentially starvation, and they had to shift off of fossil fuel-based food production to local organic production, and they did that in a matter of 18 months because they had to. They didn't have any choice. So it's, in a way, it's a very inspiring story because people mobilized and they got the job done, even though during that 18 months, the average Cuban citizen lost about 20 pounds. And I don't think they were that overweight when that started. But what people forget is that Cuba was a dictatorship. So part of what made that transition possible was that Castro dismantled the large corporate farms and made that land available to small farmers across the country. Now, we don't have that kind of situation here, but we can see, if we look at the data, if we look at what's coming with global warming, we can chart out that we're facing a global food catastrophe. It's just that most people are not aware of it. Many scientists are, some that you've spoken to. But we can begin now to prepare for that by learning how to build our local food systems. And that includes, as you talked about, each of us learning how to grow as much of our own food as we can. And it turns out that that's not as hard as many of us have been made to believe. You know, we're working right now with a gentleman in Durango, Colorado, Tom Bartels, who has a website called Grow Food Well. He's been growing food in his backyard at 6,500 feet in Durango. He's producing on a 1,200 square foot plot in his backyard. He's been growing over 1,000 pounds of his own food every year, which is about a third of what he and his wife need. But he only spends 4 or 5 hours a week on that garden. So what he's doing is teaching people how to produce food very efficiently, food that's very, very nutritious, and to be able to grow it year-round. So we're bringing Tom into the Local Food Academy to begin training other people in the academy on how they can grow their own food as much as possible, but also how to train others in their communities to do the same thing.
I'm going to look up that website. Sounds good.
Tom is outstanding, and he is one of the things I greatly appreciate is he's very well informed about the issues that you talk about on your show. He knows what's coming, and that's exactly why he's doing what he's doing. He's teaching others how to build local food production.
Michael Brownlee, do you think there's room for new technology like aquaponics or solar power in this revolutionized local food supply?
Well, I think that we will see lots of new technologies come in, and we're all already seeing that. You know, when we first started learning about hydroponics and aquaponics and year-round greenhouses, we were very encouraged because we thought that those could be great strategies. But what we're seeing is that the industrial food system is co-opting those technologies. They see that there's great opportunity there. So they're taking advantage of that and building huge systems. And the downside of that, there are several, but one of the worst is that they're driving small farmers out of existence. Small farmers cannot compete with that kind of industrial scale of production. You know, an over-reliance on technology is kind of what's gotten us into this predicament of the Anthropocene in the first place. And I think we need to be really cautious in trying to solve our problems with more technology when it turns out that just building soil is the most effective thing that we can be doing for building local food systems. It's the most effective thing that we can be doing in terms of healing and restoring and regenerating our ecosystem. So these new industrial technologies that you're talking about, they don't contribute to any of that at all. They are not regenerative systems. They will ultimately contribute to the demise of our ecosystem.
Interesting. I'm going to ask you for an update on a couple of organizations we encountered in our last Radio EcoShock interview. And the first was, now I'm going to mispronounce this, is it Poudre Valley Community Farms?
Poudre Valley Community Farms up in Fort Collins, yes. So this is a very interesting development. You know, a young farming couple up there reached a point where they couldn't grow their farm anymore. Land access is a huge problem for young farmers, almost any farmers these days. Land is getting up to about $30,000 an acre up there. So what happened was their community of customers, they had a large CSA, but then there are a lot of people in Fort Collins who are interested in food localization. They formed a multi-stakeholder cooperative to buy farmland and lease it back to young local farmers and give them a long-term lease, which would make it possible for them to stay on that land for 20, 30 years. So this is the first time that we have seen that kind of a model happen anywhere in the country. And they're in the process. They've had a few setbacks, but they're in the process of purchasing their first significant acreage right now. But they've raised the money for it. They've gotten tremendous local support. Even the local government there has gotten behind it as well. That's a very, very encouraging project.
Okay, the Taproot Cooperative. Talk to us about that.
Taproot is, you know, to me, one of the most exciting things that's happening. This grew out of originally a group of small farmers out in eastern Kansas who were growing local, growing organic food, being surrounded by industrial food production out there. Their population out in that part of the state had shrunk so much that they didn't have a market. So they wanted to see how they could get their produce and their meat to market in the Front Range of Colorado. So they've organized together. Several farmer organizations have formed cooperatives. So this is Taproot is now a network of five farmer-owned food hubs who've joined together as a cooperative to build an infrastructure backbone to move food from eastern Kansas and Nebraska and eastern Colorado into the very hungry Front Range market of Colorado, where most of Colorado's population lives. I say hungry, they're hungry for healthy local food, but are having a hard time finding access to it. So Taproot is, again, it's the first network of farmer-owned cooperative food hubs that we have seen in the country, and we think that this may turn out to be a replicable model.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. Hi, I'm Alex Smith, and I'm with Michael Brownlee. We're talking about developing, I'd say, the next generation of local food shift leaders, and that's what Michael and his partner are all about with their new book and new courses that they're offering. I'm wondering, Michael, maybe there's some places in Asia where village farming is still producing local food, and that may be the main source of nourishment for people around there. Is there a way to learn from that, to link up with that? There must be a ton of things we could learn from people all over the world.
I think that that's true. I mean, there are many places in the world where smallholder farming is still the dominant paradigm. There are a few places where the industrial food system has not co-opted that and brought in the Green Revolution. I think it's incumbent on us to go out and learn how they're doing it, see what we can apply from what they have learned over, sometimes many centuries. And I think that we also need to go back and look at the history of indigenous populations and see how they lived. You know, I was recently reading a book by Charles Massey in Australia, The Call of the Reed Warbler, which is a fantastic book. And Massey was saying that Western civilization arrived in Australia in, I think it was 1789, something like that, when the Europeans arrived, much later than happened here in this country. So it's a little easier for them to look back and see what was happening before the arrival of the Europeans. And what he describes is the Aboriginal people were living in regions that were largely self-sufficient in terms of food. And, they had their own language, but they were all connected on a spiritual level with each other. There were like 250 tribes like this. And as I read about what was happening there, these sound like localized bioregions to me, and they may provide a model for us to go back and study that give us kind of a direction for where we might need to be going in the future. I just say, especially in the context of some of the speakers that you've and authors that you've had on your show, it's pretty likely now that over the next, century or so, we're going to see a dramatic change on this planet, including a dramatic reduction in human population. We will be reorganizing how we live on this planet, those who are left. I mean, we are living in the time of a dying civilization, and almost always civilizations end with some sort of agricultural disaster, and that's what we're facing now. So we need to be able to build now our lifeboats to get through this difficult time, and we just don't see any other alternative out there that has legs other than highly regionalized food sheds, local food systems that can support local populations.
It's going to come down to that. I agree. I don't know when. Who can become a local food leader? Do we need a college degree? Do we need business experience? Do we need great public speaking skills? What are the requirements?
Well, it turns out that almost none of us have those kinds of things. The primary requirement seems to be the individuals who are deeply called to this work. They know that that's why they're here on the planet. They're totally committed, they're totally passionate, and they're looking for others that they can work with. And we're finding them. I mean, there are not maybe millions of them now, but we're finding them all over the country and in other countries as well. We just talked to a Peace Corps, a young Peace Corps volunteer in Macedonia this week, who's going to be joining the academy because she sees that this is what her life is about. So that's who we're looking for. And those people might be already involved in local food work or not. They might be farmers. We have several farmers and ranchers in the local food academy right now. They might be local food entrepreneurs or people who are involved in local food policy, but they're beginning to understand at a very deep and I would say spiritual level that this really is a matter of great urgency and importance for the human species right now.
Well, let's get in some connection points here. Michael, can you give us a website, a Twitter handle, Facebook page? How do people connect and find out more?
Right now, the best way is to go to localfoodshift.com. That's localfoodshift, ecoshock.com, and that will connect you into our system and offer you a free download of our book, Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. And then that will lead you to links with information about the Local Food Academy as well.
And as we wrap up, I want to admit that there is a spiritual side to all this. I mean, we don't want to convert people to a religion, but we believe in something so strongly, we want everyone to come along, don't you think?
The universe itself has a very strong direction. You know, Martin Luther King Jr., I believe in Selma or Montgomery back in the 60s, said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And there is an evolutionary direction of this universe that we can align with and that we can learn to embody. And we think of that as a spiritual discipline. And the most exciting thing to us about this local food revolution that's beginning to break out all over the place is that this is this bending towards justice of the universe at work. This is a process of healing and restoration and regeneration that is just beginning to take hold on our planet.
From Colorado, we've been talking with the Dean of Local Food Revolutionaries, Michael Brownlee. His latest book is Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. And check out his many free online resources, and you can even look through the book online if you like and get some ideas from that. I'd also maybe buy the book and pass it on to others. It's a good way to do it. Michael, thank you so much for being out there in front.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be with you today.
Radio EcoShock.